section 5 of 6 of the RSRNet evidence-based workshops. And today's session is on utilizing, appraising evidence developed through qualitative inquiry. And we'll be going through the article that you all should have received via email. And if not, there are extra copies up front. And I would like to welcome Dr. Judith Minum, who is from the School of Nursing at UBC. And she has an extensive background in qualitative research. And she's a co-director also of the Culture, Gender, and Health Research Unit. She's part of the UBC Behavioral Research Ethics Committee, so it'd be nice to her if you're putting in any research.
It doesn't really matter.
Her current research and scholarship is around cultural safety and knowledge uptake in clinical settings in interdisciplinary initiatives. She's using critical inquiry to engage in knowledge development for practice, and is just has a publication in press about that, and uses many qualitative methods, including ethnography. So I would like to welcome Dr. Minum.
Thank you. Well, it's great to see people in practice looking to draw upon research, because that's one of the main worries that people have who are doing research, that it won't get where it needs to be. So now, can you hear me when I'm, if I talk, can you hear? Oh, not really?
That's better.
I guess I need to be closer to this, not something. Okay, now you can hear me. All right? You could also move over to this side. But, you know, I don't want to put any pressure on you. Okay, so I did have a meeting with Wendy Hall, Dr. Wendy Hall, who gave the last session. So we did talk a little bit about where you started with this work in the last session, and then so my intention is to build from that work in what we cover today. But I'm certainly open to hearing from you if you have particular questions, or you know, there's gaps in, you know, if I've shifted in a way that you want that microphone to have.
For future generations.
Well, things will change before another generation gets this, I'm guessing. Okay, so last time, the question was, how do I know the research is any good? So the first step was how to appraise the literature in terms of theory questions, and that was Dr. Hall. And today, we're going to move forward from that and, you know, try and get our teeth into some articles. So Sandy did circulate to you the one article. I actually have also at the end of the handout that I think you all should have. I've sort of done an annotated review of a number of articles that relate to PT and OT. So hopefully we'll also get to, they use some different methodologies and things. And I just wanted to highlight some of the things that I noted when I read them. Because of copyright issues, I couldn't cut and paste them in, like the full information, but they should be available to you. They're certainly available in hard copy. They're not available as electronic journals, but we can talk about that. So the kinds of things that I want to focus on are, what are the indicators of quality in a qualitative study? So what do we, like, how do we distinguish between a mediocre or a low, something that, you know, just isn't really going to give you some of the detailed understanding. How do you distinguish that? And in developing the indicators that I'm going to talk about really come from a synthesis of literature from experts about how the movement that has taken place in the last few years around really getting to grips with what is quality. So I'll get into more specifics about that when we get to it. And then the other thing is, how do we recognize those indicators when we read? So when you're reading a study, how do you know that the quality is there? And so we'll start to talk about those things when we go through some of the examples. Okay, so that's the general aims for the day, and then we're going to practice. Okay, So I, in your handout, these are some of the resources that I drew upon that, you know, I did some reading in your disciplines just to get a sense of what were some of the things that were out there that you could then follow through on. And there's, I hope that you had a chance to look at the Kearney article. I know that, I think it was circulated to you as a citation, but this, if you only read one thing, I would recommend you read that one, because it really gets to grips with that question of levels of quality, levels of sophistication of analysis, if you will. So if a parallel that you might draw to quantitative studies is the studies that are description are distinguished from those studies that really try and get at more complex profiles of any kind of study data, etc. So that is, I find quite a helpful article to look at. And then the other one that is also, that I'll be drawing, so I'll be talking about that one. And then the other one that I'll be drawing a fair amount from is the Thorne article, which is also very clear and specifies for different methods what some of the quality criteria might be. So I found those, if you were only reading two, then I would read those two, okay? And then the others just give you some examples of what might be available. Okay, so just as a little bit, I'd like to take about 10 minutes just to review some of the main concepts underpinning qualitative work. And the reason I want to do that is because people who are working within both the qualitative and quantitative paradigm, some, you know, and a lot of us do work in both, one of the challenges or one of the common mistakes people make is that they take their critiquing criteria from the positivist or quantitative paradigm and apply it to the qualitative. And that is problematic because we don't draw on the same assumptions. So it's useful to know, you know, what are the assumptions that underpin this work, and therefore why are you looking for what you're looking for? Does that make sense to you, or it might in a few minutes? Okay, so the first, one of the first assumptions is that knowledge is perspectival. In other words, there's different, all of us sitting in the room may experience the same event, but have knowledge of it that's different from one another. And so the whole point, rather than trying to create a solitary or single perspective on something, qualitative work really tries to explicate the range of perspectives. And so there's quite that implies that there are there's not one truth, and so we're trying to sort of make those different viewpoints visible. And of course that then has implications for who's involved in the study, how people are involved in the study, et cetera, if you're really trying to accomplish that. Okay. The second assumption is that knowledge is constructed. That term is, I'm sure Wendy would have talked about that in her talk when she's, because she draws heavily on social symbolic interactionism, but as a theoretical perspective. But it basically, what it means is that what we know, how we come to know it, is developed in interaction with people. So for example, if you as a beginning practitioner had, you know, the description of a stroke or a some kind of physical challenge, and you knew it from, you know, how it affected the physical, or it was physically manifest in a person, you would have that knowledge. But then when you would interact with a patient, you would begin to extend that knowledge to understand what that means for that person, what challenges it presents for them in their day-to-day life, what it means for their spouse, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is that the knowledge of a phenomenon, it develops out of a number of different kinds of interactions. So the more the more opportunities you take to interact with people, you develop and expand your knowledge. And so the idea of research of this nature is also interactive, as opposed to standing back from the process of gathering data, as we might in the positivist paradigm. In this one, we engage and we explore. So there, you look for those opportunities for the researcher to engage with, explore, examine, et cetera, et cetera. because that's part of what we're trying to understand. Okay? Another concept that is important is reflexivity. So how do we sort of think about what's going on here? That's important in when data is gathered. It's also important in how the analysis is undertaken. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, or give you some examples of that when we look at some of the studies. Anybody, so you can see these ideas are ideas that actually challenge or are quite different from the objective, neutral position that we take in other kinds of research. Okay? Anybody want to leave yet? Okay. Perfect group. Okay. So then another issue that some studies may seek to make manifest is the way that broader social structures influence the way the experience, or shape the ways people act. So there may be some studies that move outside of that individual's understanding or knowledge to look at how the individual's context is taken up. And so I think Wendy would have talked probably about ethnographies as an example. So ethnographies are a situation where you get the view of different actors or the different people in an organization. So if you did an ethnography of a hospital, you'd want people that are at the front line. You might want patients. You might want consultants or whatever. But then you would also look at what are the policies and organizational structures that shape how frontline workers interact with people, etc. So you wouldn't consider an ethnography complete if it didn't explore structural conditions as well as a range of people's experiences within that sort of structure or social context. Okay? So if that's an aim, then that kind of data needs to be present. Okay, so the other concept, other principle is that in qualitative work, we use inductive reasoning. So we're starting usually from the ground up, and we foreground the possibility of different perspectives. Now, one of the things that sometimes people want to do qualitative work because they can stay, well, you know, we don't have any preconceived notions because this is a qualitative study. We really don't know anything and we're going to discover it all. Which is kind of a cop-out because we do often know a lot of things about what's going on. So we do. There is an expectation that a qualitative study is positioned in what is known. And the point of the qualitative study is to make manifest or some understanding of new understandings of why, for example, why we see this particular profile of, if, for example, you have people who engage in their... let's say diabetics, they do their diabetic teaching and they follow through, and then 6 months after they've been diagnosed, they start not to follow through anymore. I mean, let's say we had all this statistical information that gave this profile of following your protocol and then declining. Well, a qualitative study might be able to get at, well, what happens at that six-month period, or what's starting to change, influence why people are choosing not to follow. Oops. Why people might be choosing not to follow. So we can use that broader or that other data to shape why we're asking our question, as opposed to saying nobody knows anything about, you know, this particular population, so we need to do a qualitative study to start with. So that's, you used to be able to get away with that, but you can't anymore. Okay. The other thing is that what we're trying to do often in qualitative work is generate some insights about the particular. Whereas in quantitative study, we're trying to generalize about a population or make generalizations about a phenomenon. In other words, if everybody takes this medication, their blood pressure will drop, or 95% of the people's blood pressure will drop. We want to be able to make some claims in that way. Here, we're trying to understand the particular. What is it about this group of people's experiences that makes, you know, that accounts for variation or difference, or we're getting into the sort of detail and messiness, and the analysis should take that into, you know, should be able to make that manifest in some way. So it could be particular because of context, it could be because of how it's experienced by the individuals, or it might be because of where it's positioned in history. So those are the kinds of influences on things that we might be wanting to know. Okay, so then what kind of knowledge are we generating? So if these are the assumptions that we're building from, where are we going with this? So one of the things, instead of generating facts, you know, we can say that, you know, predict or talk about frequencies or whatever. We may be talking about processes. That might be one kind of knowledge that we generate. So, for example, how does power operate in a situation where people are in, let's say, a relationship with a caregiver? If you're dependent, on a caregiver for certain services, how does the power in that relationship operate and influence how you make requests, negotiate that relationship, for example? Some of the work I'm doing looks at how marginalizing processes, so assumptions people hold about groups, how are they taken up and how do they play out in interactions? So we come to understand why particular people may see themselves as excluded from different arenas, etc., which may not be really that visible. So we may look at how an event or illness is managed or viewed over time. So we talk like illness, the illness trajectory work or the grieving process work. All those are concepts and insights that have been generated largely through qualitative work. So that doesn't mean everybody's going to follow through exactly, but it gives us some way of starting to think where is someone at in this experience, etc. Does that make sense to you? You've probably drawn on a lot of that work in general, right, in your understanding and practice. Okay, so Thorne talks about another aim as being the development of an analytic structure to give us a different way of looking at a situation or phenomenon. And to understand why it might operate in a particular way. So there's a range of outcomes that you might be seeing in the products of a qualitative study, and we'll come back to that. Okay, so the criteria for a quality study, now there's terms, I don't know if Wendy introduced terms like rigor, auditability, there's some different kinds of terms. And then those terms have also been challenged, like rigor, is it rigor mortis? Like, you know, people sort of take this up and say, well, you have to do it. You know, these are, they're sort of ideas about how to proceed. So, but basically, what we're looking for evidence of is that the researcher was systematic in how they approach the study, and you can see that. They're rigorous and clear in, you know, how they articulated what they did. And that it's the work, the analysis, the whole process is auditable. So, you know, we know from an accounting perspective, when they say follow the money, you know, you can see how decisions are made in an organization. So we should be able to, there should be enough information in how an analysis is presented or a study is presented to, for us to see the decisions that the researcher made. Now the issue, one of the things that's different here than what we might see in a positive, in a quantitative study is we may not necessarily, we may bring a different interpretation to what those data say, but we should be able, the researcher's decisions, we should be able to see why they made them and that they, you know, that they make sense to us. So that they shouldn't be saying, well, this is something, and then you read the example if it's a data set and then say, well, it's not that, I don't see the link between that claim and that example at all. So that's what we mean by auditable. You may read it and say, oh, you know, the researcher missed an idea. You could also make this argument, but that may or may not challenge the argument that they do make. So it's about being accountable to your data and how you undertook your analysis. Okay, so we talked about context. So you reviewed the theoretical and methodological perspectives, I think. And so in appraising quality, the kinds of things that we're looking for are are those principles of the methodology upheld in how the research is undertaken? So often, and we'll go through some examples of this, often you read a study and the researcher says, well, it's a qualitative study. And then they draw upon something, you know, a reference from phenomenology to explain why they asked the questions they did. And then they draw upon a reference from grounded theory to explain why they did their analysis this way. And then they draw upon an ethnographic reference to justify some other decision they made. So I would begin to argue that there isn't congruence in how that study was undertaken, because each of those requires different kinds of data and has different sets of expectations. So part of what you're looking for when you do your critique is there congruence between what the question is, how the data were gathered, and how they were now analyzed. So congruence is one key idea. So that's, is there a link between the methodology and the methods, etc. And then, of course, just as if you were doing a quantitative study, if you don't know what the statistical analysis is, you look it up, because there's so many that you may not know. So basically, if you don't know the methodology and you're reading it, you can even just, now Google Scholar or something like that, you can get some really good, you know, concise definitions of a particular method just to give you some clues to what you're looking for. But you may need to go and find some supporting literature if you're not sure about the particular methodology. But the idea is, were the methods, i.e. what the researcher did, are they consistent with the methodology? Are you with me on this? You're okay with that? Okay. And the same thing comes about sampling. So that are the principles of sampling that were used, are they informed by the methodology or the methodological perspective that you're drawing upon? So for an example of that would be phenomenological studies that you all know is, I think, about experience. Like, so how I experience this phenomenon, whatever it happens to be. And ethnography, we just talked about, is about trying to understand the culture of a organization or a group or something. Well, a phenomenology then has to be engaging with a person about the whole sort of sensory, emotional dimensions of their experience. But if you just did that kind of interview for an ethnography, you wouldn't meet the demands of what an ethnography is about. So you would need to have other data in an ethnography. So that's what I mean by the sample. So in an ethnography, you'd want the whole range of people in the organization, whereas in a phenomenology, you may just want the people with the illness or the caregivers looking after the people with the illness or something like that. Okay. So usually purpose of sampling is the term that we see, and the key concepts would be knowledge of the phenomenon, their position within an organization, or their ability to speak to the topic because they're of their position in an organization or whatever. So those would be the kinds of, we would select people or invite people who, you know, are positioned in relation to the topic that we're interested in. So you do a quantitative study, you identify, you do a power analysis, see how many people do you need to have involved in order for this to be good data. In qualitative, we're looking at the criteria around adequacy. How do I know I've talked to enough people or I've gathered enough, made enough observations, is related to depth of data, which may not mean 100 people seen for half an hour. It may mean 20 people seen for 10 hours each or something like that. So depth, because we're looking for quality and detail. Duration, if we're looking at processes, we may need to see people over time to try and understand how their view of things changes. Or we may monitor, you know, get people at different points in time, depending on what our question might be. But it's about, again, depth, duration. And then the other piece is, what level of complexity are we trying to achieve in our analysis? So if our aims are to come up with a description, you know, a detailed description of something, we may not need quite as much variation in our sample as it would be if we are trying to come up with a whole sort of theoretical conception of a process and how and all the different ways that process might unfold across a population of people. So we'll talk a little bit more about how you would know that or how that might be manifest. Another term you might see is the category saturated. We sometimes joke when we're reviewing proposals, because if you're reviewing some proposals, you know, people say, well, you know, categories will be saturated after 8 interviews. And other people say categories will be saturated after 50 interviews. And it's a judgment. It's definitely a judgment. And so the issue is, how has the researcher convinced you that there is a lot of depth and detail and variation, and that you can see that the ideas in this study or in these data are being echoed in other people or in other people, you know, in other data accounts.
So does that refer, sorry, that there's a large enough sample that
the person's... Adequacy, yeah. So it could be, see, when we say large, often we think numbers of people, right, or numbers of interviews, but it's really, like sometimes a really good qualitative study could be, you know, talking to 5 people, but doing that for 3 people, but doing that for a year, and getting into the, you know, the details of their everyday life, which would be adequate, but different from talking to 25 people for 2 or 3 times over 6 months or something like that. Okay. And the more with ground theory in particular, they have some additional terms. So they might talk about exploring the negative case or talking about theoretically sampling. So once they've done some preliminary analyses, they might see, well, everybody was having this, you know, talking in this way about the experience, and then we get what would be called an outlier. So in quantitative work, you can say, well, that's an outlier, or it's not statistically significant. In qualitative work, you then have to say, well, what is it about that person or that story, and how does it relate to this? So, you know, is it because it was an older person or a younger person or a man or a woman or someone that was newly diagnosed, or what, you know, what was it about their experience that made it so different? And then you may theoretically sample additional people to on those lines in order to try and see what, you know, to see if you can flesh that out. So we, in the analysis, try and conceptually take account of that, what might be considered the negative case. So you're looking at influences, okay? So in a good study, the analysis should be explicitly described and then illustrated with examples, talked about, the decisions made, talked about, so that you really can sort of see how they got, the researcher or research team generated this analysis. And then again, that internal consistency. Okay, so these are the steps of analysis that Thorne talks about. And sometimes what happens in the history of qualitative work, let me put it this way, probably 20 or so years ago, there was a lot of sort of theoretical work around qualitative inquiry. So there was a lot of theoretical work about phenomenology and the sort of thinking roots of that. And then you'd read a product of the phenomenological study. But the steps in between were kind of like a black box. There was no sort of way of doing that. And people, you know, I remember students sort of trying to take up this work saying things like, I being one of them, well, actually, how do you get from here to there? And who talks about that? In the early 80s, there was Glaser and Strauss were... developed their grounded theory methodology and theoretical perspective. And they were really the first ones that sort of said, this is how you do it, and they illustrated that and they taught it, etc. As a consequence, a lot of people start from a different philosophical or methodological positions, but then use grounded, some of the tenets of grounded theory in undertaking their analysis, because there's actually some direction for that. There now is other work as well that there's a lot more written about analysis. But part of why I'm telling you that is because a lot of things, when you read articles, they may start here, draw upon a little bit of this, and then go back to something else. So that's I think that's partly why, because there's a bit of a black box around analysis. So some of the more recent work, including Thorne's work, is contributing to the making more visible the steps or the ways in which researchers move through this process. So her languaging is comprehending, synthesizing, so getting a general sense of the phenomenon, illustrating how it is manifest in different people's, from different people's perspectives, then also moving beyond just that which would be descriptive at that point, to starting to speculate, well, why is this happening, and engaging with the broader theory. So if there's a theory of something, you might say, well, how does what these people have, this data or this analysis that we've generated to this point, how does this articulate with what common understanding is, or the other people's positions on this? And then perhaps refining or thinking it through and taking it to another level. So she's kind of giving us showing the, in a way, the trajectory of analysis. And so you may see some general description at the comprehending or synthesizing, but then you may see some other, the same author may take it further in another, the same data in another kind of publication. So these are just some questions about, questions you might ask as you're reading, you know, do you understand how the analysis was undertaken? And the auditability, which we talked about. You have those notes. Okay, now this is some. So anybody have any questions so far? Is this sounding familiar? Okay. I don't know if you're familiar with the pyramid of evidence in quantitative research. The pyramid is that it's a pyramid that sort of articulates what is the basic kind of most basic research in the positivist paradigm, with at the top is the meta-syntheses and the randomized controlled trials, down to the base of the pyramid, which is more descriptive, etc. Well, if you take that pyramid and apply it to qualitative work, then qualitative work would always be at the bottom of the pyramid because of the rules that are applied. So I'm sort of proposing that there's a qualitative equivalent to the pyramid. And two different positions that you might take around quality, Morse would say it's around the significance. So how useful and significant is this, the product of this study? How will it, you know, influence or change practice or offer understandings that we didn't have before? So she's talking about significance in a particular way, not in the statistical way. And then Kearney, the article that I suggested that you look at, talks about the levels of complexity and discovery and as her sort of contribution to that pyramid. And so the highest level for her is of complexity is this a linking of discrete findings into a web, multifaceted web of interactions. And she argues that the higher, the more complex analysis considers both the context of the phenomenon and then the individual's sort of relationship to that broader phenomenon. So that's her sort of idea of where we would ideally like to go if we want to really get some complex insights or understandings. And then her notion of discovery isn't that something didn't exist before, but that the qualitative, a really good analysis will put us in a position of understanding this phenomenon in a new way, or have a kind of aha, oh, like I never thought of it that way, and you know, with this understanding, I might interact with people in a different way, or I might ask different questions of them when I'm, you know, working with them, etc. So it starts to give us a different way of thinking about something, and that's what she would call discovery. And so in her, if we use that paradigm or that analogy, then descriptive methods achieve a lower level of complexity, and interpretive and theorizing methods provide a higher level. So this is her, I have it on your handout there, but the top here would be your higher level of complexity and discovery, with the bottom being a lower level. And that isn't to say that there each doesn't contribute, you know, each level doesn't contribute to our understanding or knowledge. I mean, I'm not arguing that everybody should be striving for that higher level, but it does give you some way of starting to look at, when you're reading a study, saying, well, where does this contribute? You know, if I was going to pick one of four studies on something, which, you know, to make sense of an event or a phenomenon, which, you know, these might be criteria we would apply to sort of say, well, which one gives me the best, most detailed insights or understanding.
Sorry, Judith, is this accepted as is this pyramid something that, for example, there's communities of practice work being done right now on wound care proposal, and we're collecting all the information that's being published within, you know, certain databases within a certain period of time, and trying to come up with what the standards of practice should be.
Right.
So when you go to the qualitative work, this is how we would rank the qualitative studies.
Well, I mean, to me, you're ranking them on the basis of what's your question. So that's the first thing, right? So you're thinking, well, you may very well need that descriptive, like what's the range of ways that, in fact, there was a dissertation work and then a big study that was done in Britain that was actually a qualitative analysis of they created a category of classification for wound,
staging,
really. And then on the basis of that, they developed a whole protocol for dealing with it. But it was a qualitative study, so it began with descriptive. But then they moved to understand, like looking at how it was managed as well, so then they started to incorporate how it was dealt with. So that would be a different level of, you know, have moved beyond description. So there's a play, if you're doing a clinical practice guideline, or you're trying to synthesize all of the evidence on wound care, they would contribute in different ways.
Right.
So one might simply give you, you know, the range of things, the descriptive range, and then the others might start to say, well, what are the ways that it responds to different kinds of practice initiatives or something.
But you couldn't say that, you know, have categorized according to this pyramid of quality of qualitative.
You could, if you wanted to do that. The difference that you might get would be, for example, in the descriptive ones, you would just simply say there is, you know, there is, you know, 1 centimeter. If you were, let's say you're doing bed sores or whatever, that, you know, it's this size and this, and you know, there's this many of them. Whereas if you're getting up to the complex thing, you're getting at, you know, who are the people that were more likely to have them, what was the going on in the practice context that might have made, you know, so you're getting at conditions that influence the prevalence and incidence perhaps, but in a qualitative way. So yeah, you could rank them that way. Okay. The other thing is about the lower level may just tell you what you already know. Everybody knows it. So the other ones may start to give you some ways of dealing with it, you know, link it to other things that, that you hadn't maybe thought about as considerations. Okay? Okay. So, is this, or do what, are you, do you want, should we just keep going? Are you needing a break or anything? Yeah.
Do you want to grab a juice and something and then come back?
Do you want to take, so why don't we just take a couple of minutes and then we'll move.